Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. The stream of refugees into Europe continues Monday. The passage through Hungary is much smoother than it was last week, when the Central European nation seemed ready to do whatever it could to prevent the migrants from entering the wealthier Western European nations. Hungarians are now posting Austrian train schedules for the refugees at Budapest Kaleti station. Last week, police tear gassed the migrants at Kaleti who wanted to go to Austria. One observer said the trains to Austria are now just loaded with migrants. Germany said Monday it's making an additional $6.6 billion in public funds available next year to absorb the refugees into German society. France has announced a twofold response to Syria's widening crisis. Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris.
President François Hollande said France will begin surveillance flights of Islamic State positions in Syria as of Tuesday. Those may lead to possible strikes against the terrorist group.
Aujourd'hui en Syrie, ce que nous voulons connaître, savoir.
In a wide-ranging press conference, Hollande said the flights aimed to find out what actions the Islamic State group was preparing against France and its allies and against the Syrian population. But he ruled out putting French boots on the ground as inconsequential and unrealistic. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Representatives from North and South Korea began talks Monday aimed at resuming the reunion of families separated over 60 years by the Korean War. Red Cross officials from both Seoul and Pyongyang sat down in the truce village of Panmunjom. This is VOA. Pakistan's military says that its locally developed drone has carried out its first missile strike, killing at least three high-profile militants near the Afghan border. Military spokesman Major General Asim Bajwa, in a brief statement, said the unmanned aircraft named Barak attacked what he called a terrorist compound Monday in the volatile Shawal Valley of North Waziristan, a remote tribal district. No other details have been made available about those killed or whether any civilians were among the victims. The area is not accessible for reporters and aid workers. Guatemala faces a presidential runoff after the leading candidates at the polls on Sunday failed to secure the votes needed to avoid a second round of elections next month. Jimmy Morales, a comedic actor and political novice, led with 24%, according to early results. With about 95% of votes tallied early Monday, conservative businessman Manuel Baldizon and former First Lady Sandra Torres are vying for runner-up, each with about 19%. Morales's campaign slogan, "Not corrupt, not a thief," resonated with voters after a bribery scandal ended in the resignation of President Otto Perez Molina on Thursday. President Barack Obama is marking the Labor Day holiday in the United States by requiring paid sick leave for 300,000 employees of federal contractors. Mr. Obama, a Democrat in his last 16 months in office, has been stymied by opposition to several of his labor proposals by the Republican-controlled Congress. He is, however, signing an executive order at a Boston rally for union workers to authorize up to 7 paid sick leave days a year, starting in 2017, for those working for companies with federal government contracts. The sick leave would let the workers care for themselves or other family members, such as a child, a parent, or a spouse. Again, our leading news story, the stream of refugees into Europe is continuing. The passage through Hungary is much smoother than it was last week, when the Central European nation seemed ready to do whatever it could to prevent the migrants from entering the wealthier Western European nations. One observer said the trains to Austria are now just loaded with migrants. I am Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
France has announced a twofold response to Syria's widening crisis, with plans to launch surveillance flights and possibly strikes against the Islamic State group on Syrian territory, while opening its doors to thousands of more Syrian and other refugees who have fled to Europe.
That's Lisa Bryant reporting from Paris. Details coming up also in the news. Cameroon says terrorism threats loom as millions of school children return to school today after a three-month holiday. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the chief of the European Union says members will discuss on Wednesday a plan to relocate 120,000 refugees that have been flooding into Europe's frontline countries. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker says the proposal commits Germany and France to take half of the refugees to ease the burden on Greece, Italy and Hungary. Spain would receive 5,000. The UN estimates 200,000 refugees need to be relocated. Meanwhile, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has been criticized by other EU politicians for refusing to let refugees, mostly from Syria, Afghanistan and Iraq, cross Hungary's border into Austria and Germany. Thousands of protesting refugees surrounded the main railway station in Budapest, while the Hungarian government blocked refugee entry into the EU for several days. However, over the weekend, the government reversed its strict transit policies. Mr. Orban is opposed to new immigrants in his country. He told the reporters today that tens of millions of people, not tens of thousands, could arrive on the continent. He warned that more will come from Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nigeria, and Mali. In response to Mr. Orban's opposition to the refugees, the head of the Swiss Social Democratic Party says his government should cut financial aid to Hungary and ban Mr. Orban from entering Switzerland. France has announced a twofold response to Syria's widening crisis, with plans to launch surveillance flights and possibly strikes against the Islamic State group on Syrian territory, while opening its doors to thousands more Syrian and other refugees who have fled to Europe. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
President François Hollande said France will begin surveillance flights of Islamic State positions in Syria as of Tuesday. Those may lead to possible strikes against the terrorist group.
Aujourd'hui en Syrie, ce que nous voulons connaître, savoir.
In a wide-ranging press conference, Hollande said the flights aimed to find out what actions the Islamic State group was preparing against France and its allies and against the Syrian population. But he ruled out putting French boots on the ground as inconsequential and unrealistic. The French president spoke as thousands of Syrians and other refugee seekers continued their march towards Austria and Germany after having crossed the Mediterranean Sea to safety. With about 350,000 arriving on its shores this year, Europe faces its biggest refugee crisis since World War II.
La Commission européenne propose ou va proposer.
Hollande said France is willing to take 24,000 asylum seekers out of about 160,000 the European Union's executive arm wants to divide up among member states over the next 2 years. That may include hundreds of those newly arrived in Germany.
C'est le devoir de la France. La France ou le droit d'asile.
Hollande said the right to asylum was an integral part of France and its history. He warned against the walls and closed-door policies of Eastern and Central European nations, suggesting the very future of Europe's borderless Schengen system and EU unity is at stake. Hollande also warned against the lack of progress in climate talks ahead of December's climate change summit in Paris. Climate change may send millions of refugees fleeing to Europe, he said, rather than the hundreds of thousands the region is grappling with today. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Cameroon says terrorism threats loom as millions of schoolchildren return to school today after a three-month holiday. The country has taken measures to make school campuses safe, especially on its northern border with Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
16-year-old Amidou Moussa is one of the millions of Cameroon students who go back to school Monday after the three-month holiday. But he says he cannot return to classes in the Cameroonian town of Mora on the border with Nigeria because of suicide bombings. He says he was not really disturbed during the holiday period because his parents took him far away from the conflict-prone border zone to Cameroon's capital Yaoundé, which is safer. Valentine Tame, president of the Teachers Association of Cameroon, says many teachers are also refusing to teach in localities along Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria.
We are appealing to those who have been posted there that that is Cameroon. You have to go there and do your work. But we are also more loudly telling government that they have a moral duty to take care of those teachers there.
Nze Emostala of the communication unit of Cameroon's police has been assuring students, teachers and their parents that security has been increased on school campuses in border localities. He says if the population cooperates with authorities, the terrorists will find it difficult to operate.
The very, very little ones must be accompanied to school, especially those who are going to school for the first time. Not to hand their property to people they do not know, not to take food from people they do not know, not to accept assistance from people that they don't know. That is a moment, too, that the kidnappers or people with intentions will take children like that, and at the end, they will be somewhere else. They must be taught to avoid bad company. They must be taught to make new friends with a lot of caution. Most of all, if they notice anything, they should report it immediately to the security officials they see. They are their friends and not their enemies.
Last year, Cameroon closed 70 schools on its northern border with Nigeria's Borno State. More than 100,000 students were relocated to new schools to keep them away from the insurgents that vowed to attack Cameroon for taking part in efforts to eradicate the terrorist group. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You are listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Thirteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The chief of the European Union says members will discuss on Wednesday a plan to relocate 120,000 refugees that have been flooding into Europe's frontline countries. France has announced a twofold response to Syria's widening crisis. And Cameroon says terrorism threats loom as millions of schoolchildren return to school today after a three-month holiday. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C. The 14th World Forestry Congress is being held in Durban, South Africa this week. The conference is held every 6 years. The theme is Forests and People Investing in a Sustainable Future. The UN Food and Agricultural Organization says over the past 25 years, the world's forests have changed in dynamic and diverse ways. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The FAO has released its Global Forest Resources Assessment for 2015. Senior Forestry Officer Kenneth McDicken is among those monitoring how the forests are faring.
What we've seen is a continued forest loss, forest area loss in the tropics, not surprisingly, but The good news is that it's happening at a rate that is half of what it was in the 1990s. So the deforestation rate is slowing. There's still continued natural forest loss, and there is continuing planted forest increase. But overall, the forest area dynamics, you could say, are improving.
That's due, he says, to more countries sustainably managing their forests. As of 2014, 112 countries had national forest inventories.
I think it's probably more reduction in areas converted for agriculture than anything else. The prime driver in the tropics certainly is agriculture. That process is slowing.
The FAO report says that countries have more knowledge of their forest resources than ever before. However, between 1990 and 2015, there was a net loss of 129 million hectares of forest. That's an area about the size of South Africa, the country where the World Forestry Conference is being held. The biggest forest loss occurred in Africa and South America. The report says challenges remain. It warns the existence of sound policies, legislation, and regulation is not always coupled with effective incentives or enforcement, and that unsustainable forest practices and forest conversion to farmland clearly persist. The United Nations opens a summit September 25th to adopt the proposed 17 Sustainable Development Goals. They'll replace the Millennium Development Goals that expire after 15 years. Sustainable management of forests is expected to be included. The FAO forestry officer is concerned about recent human impact. Since 1990, the population has grown by 37%. Agricultural food demand has increased by 40%. At the same time, MacDicken says, forest areas have declined by 3.2%.
I think that there's reason to be concerned about forest area. We're using more wood than ever before. We're using 200 million cubic meters more wood now than we were in 1990. That wood has to come from somewhere. It provides important products for all sorts of purposes. There's probably no person on earth that doesn't use wood products in some form or another.
So he says producing more wood must be balanced with protecting watersheds, biodiversity, and forests' role in absorbing carbon emissions. MacDicken says while a direct impact of climate change on forests is hard to measure, indirect effects are being monitored. These include more large wildfires and destructive insects and diseases that are not killed off by milder winters. The mountain pine beetle, for example, has destroyed millions of hectares of trees over the years. But he says the biggest challenge is actually not knowing what all the challenges are.
Forests are complicated. They are complex, dynamic landscapes. And, well, we've learned an awful lot about them in the last 200 years or so. There's still a lot that we don't know. We don't know how able they will be to respond to changes in environment. As populations, they can't move very far, very fast. So they can't keep up, in many cases, to climate change.
On the other hand, he says, scientists are discovering more species of trees that are better able to adapt. The first FAO Global Forest Resources Assessment was released in 1948. The 2015 report says managing forests responsibly and sustainably requires a balanced approach encompassing the three pillars of sustainability: economic, social, and environmental. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Law enforcement and wildlife officials from eight African countries have joined forces for a training program aimed at bringing wildlife traffickers to justice. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
The program, co-sponsored by the African Wildlife Foundation, an international fund for animal welfare, is designed to familiarize officials and law enforcers with ways of stopping traffickers of illegal animal products. The initiative is known as ARREST, or Africa's Regional Response to Endangered Species Trafficking. Ethiopia, Kenya, Mozambique, Republic of Congo, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda and Zambia are taking part. Samuel Mutai, the head of Wildlife Trade Project East Africa, explains.
This is a detect training, which is the detection of environmental crime training. It basically targets wildlife agencies, prosecutors, police and customs who are going to be trained on issues on how to handle wildlife crime issues.
Participants learn how to use sniffer dogs when conducting searches, how to check containers and cargo at ports and airports, and how to prepare documentation for prosecutors and police so it can be valid in front of a judge. Mutai says the wildlife agencies expect to improve cross-border and regional collaboration in the fight against crimes, such as illegal ivory and rhino horn trafficking, which have been on the increase.
Wildlife trafficking is a cross-border issue. When you have all these countries, it would be easy to handle these cases. If someone does commit a crime in Kenya, then if he's traveling either to Ethiopia, to Tanzania, or to Uganda, then information can be able to be shared within the channels.
The investigative teams established under arrest will talk with those under a similar program in Asia. The training is expected to conclude on Friday. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa made it all the more clear that when it comes to infectious disease, the best offense is a good defense. That is the goal for public health experts who will meet in Seoul, South Korea, stopping future epidemics before they start. Dr. Tom Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, spoke with VOA's Carol Pearson in Atlanta.
The Ebola epidemic that swept through West Africa and is not over yet shows the urgency in containing infectious diseases. For all its horror, Ebola isn't the deadliest disease. But with Ebola, death comes swiftly and painfully. The virus spreads rapidly, leaving in its wake orphans, widows and widowers, and devastated economies. Ebola shines a glaring light on weaknesses in healthcare systems.
There's no vaccine for Ebola.
Governments, donor countries, health workers, nonprofits, volunteers, and health agencies like the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, have worked to combat the disease.
We've done more than 23,000 laboratory tests for Ebola in West Africa. We've had staff do contact tracing, monitoring of cases and contacts in virtually every community where the disease has been spreading. We've analyzed the data to help improve the response so we can target efforts where they would have the most effectiveness.
Dr. Tom Frieden, the director of the CDC, went to West Africa to learn about the epidemic. Now he and other experts are working to stop whatever comes next.
The most important single lesson from Ebola in West Africa is that every country needs the ability to do three things: find a health threat when it first emerges, stop it promptly, and prevent it wherever possible.
To do that, all countries need good laboratories, surveillance systems, and trained health workers. That's a priority for the Global Health Security Agenda, an international effort by nations and organizations to make the world safe from infectious diseases. No one knows what new deadly disease will come next or where it will strike. But with increased travel and global commerce, Frieden and other public health experts know that an outbreak of a deadly infectious disease anywhere threatens the health of people everywhere. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Atlanta.
And in news from outside the continent, the UN-backed war crimes court trying the two surviving leaders of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge regime heard its first day of evidence today on the charge of genocide, as Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh.
The tribunal last year found the Khmer Rouge's two surviving former leaders guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity, a ruling that both men have appealed. Monday's hearing marks the presentation of evidence in the prosecution's effort to prove the much more difficult charge of genocide, the first time in the court's 9-year history that it is hearing testimony on that alleged crime. But the charge of genocide does not refer to the mass killings of ordinary Cambodians. The ethnic Khmer, who constituted the majority of the country's population during the Khmer Rouge's brutal 1975 to 1979 rule, and who comprised the majority of its victims. Instead, it relates specifically to the regime's actions against two minority groups, ethnic Cham Muslims and ethnic Vietnamese. Lars Olsen is the tribunal's public affairs officer.
The reason the genocide charges are limited to these two groups is basically because the legal definition of genocide is different from what many people would regard as genocide.
Simply put, says Olsen, genocide refers to having the intention to eliminate in part or in full a group of people based on their race, religion, ethnicity, or nationality.
Clearly, in this context of Cambodia, where the majority of the Cambodians who were killed during the Khmer Rouge regime was killed by Cambodians with the same ethnicity, simply the traditional legal definition of genocide would not include these kind of acts.
The Khmer Rouge's persecution of ethnic Cham Muslims and ethnic Vietnamese, the prosecution says, does fit that definition. And on Monday, the tribunal heard testimony from It Sain, a 63-year-old Cham farmer. It Sain told the court that after the Khmer Rouge took control of his area in eastern Cambodia in 1973, they barred residents from practicing their religion and customs, even their language, on pain of death. The voice you can hear is that of the court interpreter.
Only Khmer language was allowed to speak at that time. We could speak Cham, but you know, in a secret way, not loudly. If they happened to hear we speaking Cham language, we would be taken away and killed.
The Khmer Rouge's persecution of the Cham Muslims, a distinct ethnic group with their own customs and religion, has been well documented. The Khmer Rouge regarded the Cham as enemies and dealt brutally with them. Large numbers of Cham Muslims were murdered. In one district, the Khmer Rouge arrested and killed every Cham villager. In 1975, Pol Pot told cadre to force Cham Muslims to raise pigs and eat pork, and said those who refused must be killed. The Khmer Rouge destroyed and desecrated mosques, burned Qurans and sacred texts, and executed Cham leaders. Most Cham who were not killed were dispersed, forcibly married into other communities, and barred on pain of death from practicing all aspects of their culture. By the time Pol Pot's regime was overthrown in early 1979, it is thought that one-third of the pre-regime Cham population, which numbered about 300,000, were dead. It Sain, who was ordered out of his village in 1975, was one of the few from his village to survive. His wife and child did not. During his testimony, he spoke of witnessing a day-long massacre of his fellow Chams, dozens of whom were roped together at a time, the rope attached to a boat, and the prisoners dragged into the center of the river. It Sain managed to escape the house in which he was being held and swam downstream to safety. The prosecution contends that what happened to It Sain and his fellow Chams constitutes genocide, as were the actions taken by the Khmer Rouge against Cambodia's ethnic Vietnamese minority, which also included mass deportations and killings. By 1979, Cambodia's ethnic Vietnamese population had been nearly eliminated. In the coming weeks, more witnesses are scheduled to testify. This second mini-trial of the two surviving leaders is likely to last into 2016. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next on Let's Talk, wife earning more money than her husband. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing this sensitive issue. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The chief of the European Union says members will discuss on Wednesday a plan to relocate 120,000 refugees that have been flooding into Europe's frontline countries. France has announced a twofold response to Syria's widening crisis. And Cameroon says terrorism threats loom as millions of school children return to school today after a three-month holiday. Coming up, music from Cameroon. And in our feature segment, in Sierra Leone, an experimental Ebola vaccine is being deployed in Cambia district, where a new case of the virus was detected recently. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with African football.
Yehiz, it was a big weekend in African football. There were 25 qualifying matches played for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament, which will be hosted by Gabon. In one of the highlights, Africa's newest country, South Sudan, scored the biggest victory in the team's young history. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi, tells us more.
South Sudan recorded its first ever competitive win after beating Equatorial Guinea by a lone goal in their Group C clash in Juba. Striker Chol Peter Bentiu Daniel played his way into the history books by scoring the only goal of the match on 51 minutes. It was the first win in a competitive outing for South Sudan since joining the ambit of international football in 2012. Picking the maximum points at the expense of a team such as Equatorial Guinea, semi-finalists at the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, is no mean feat for South Sudan.
Thanks, Shagun. That's our Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot, on the spot at Adeyemi. And let's give a sunny side of sports salute to South Sudan for its big 1-0 victory over Equatorial Guinea in Juba. Now let's go to Port Harcourt, Nigeria, where underdog Sierra Leone held reigning African champion Ivory Coast to a scoreless draw in another 2017 Nations Cup qualifier. Sierra Leone's Ghanaian coach, Celis Tete, had this to say after the game.
The game was two halves. Definitely the first half was quite balanced, which of course it was equally interesting. But the second half, yes, you might say it was one-sided, but we also, in our few counter-attacks, we were a little bit dangerous too. But I think this is a game which tactically it worked perfectly for us. We did less mistakes. We did more of the covering up. We did more of the tackling. And I think we did it very well. And certainly we deserve this draw. And I'm satisfied with the draw.
With that draw, Celis Tete and Sierra Leone now have 1 point from two qualifying matches in Group I, the only group with three teams. Sudan, which was idle over the weekend, tops the group with 3 points after beating Sierra Leone 1-0 in June. Ivory Coast now has 1 point from one qualifier. The French head coach of Ivory Coast is Michel Dussier.
It's not the result we hoped to get today, but we didn't play well in the first half. We were lacking of aggressivity, and it was we had let this team of Sierra Leone to take confidence, and it was more difficult for us. In the second half, we have tried to push hard, but the pitch was not so good at the end, so it was difficult to play football. So at the end, it's a draw. It's not the result we hoped, but let's see. It's a draw first. Yes, of course, I'm disappointed with the result, but as I said, Sierra Leone is is a good team. They fight very hard to get this result.
That's Michel Dussier, the French head coach of African football champion Ivory Coast. And he was speaking in Port Harcourt, Nigeria. And thanks to reporter Tony Tamino in Port Harcourt for collecting that audio for us. The Sierra Leone-Ivory Coast match was played in Port Harcourt because of the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone, and it counted as a home match for Sierra Leone. Now let's go to Monrovia, where host Liberia edged Tunisia 1-0 on a goal by striker Francis Doe in the 79th minute. For reaction, my VOA colleague James Buddy called Monrovia, where he reached the president of the Liberia Football Association, Musa Bility.
We're very excited. The Liberian people deserve nothing, especially after Ebola. We deserve nothing less. We're very happy. The whole country team behind the national team. I think we are off to a very good start after such a very, very, very difficult year for the people of Liberia.
What sort of team is Liberia fielding this time around?
90% of our players are foreign-based, and we have two local-based players that started the match.
So when's the next match for the Lone Stars?
Well, we play Guinea-Bissau in the World Cup preliminary, home and away. On the 8th of October, we will be playing Guinea-Bissau. And if we pass through that, another month later, we will be meeting Ivory Coast.
That's Musa Bility, the president of the Liberia Football Association, and he was talking from Monrovia with my VOA colleague, James Buddy. Liberia now has 3 points from 2 matches in Group A of 2017 Nations Cup qualifying. Tunisia also has 3 points, while Togo, which scored a 2-0 road victory over Djibouti, has the maximum 6 points from 2 matches. Djibouti is at the bottom of the table with no points. Now, under the qualifying format, the 13 group winners and the 2 runners-up with the best records will join host Gabon at the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.
And when you visit VOANews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled One-on-One with Luol Deng, and I reflect on the recent visit by the South Sudan-born basketball star to our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. During his visit, I asked the Miami Heat forward, do you still have goals you'd like to accomplish?
I just turned 30, so I think I still have a lot of years ahead of me. So there's a lot that I want to accomplish before I finish. I think the main things that I focused on is how good can I be? I think every year I push myself to try to see how much better I could get. I think at the end, I just have to be, you know, look at myself and say I gave it everything I can. And that's all you can do.
What do you think of Miami's chances this coming season?
I'm really excited. I think that, you know, as a player, you always want to be honest with yourself and with your teammates. And, you know, you always look at the team and see what kind of chances that you have. And as a competitor, you always every year think you have a chance. But I really mean it this time when I say that we really have a great team, a great starting five and a great bench. I think that, you know, you go into the season with a lot of confidence. So it's going to be an exciting year.
That's South Sudan-born basketball star Luol Deng looking forward to an exciting year with the Miami Heat Club. And Lou was talking with me at our VOA studios here in Washington. The 30-year-old Deng played his first 10 seasons in the NBA with the Chicago Bulls. He then played about half an NBA season, or 40 games, with the Cleveland Cavaliers before moving to Miami last season. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see some nice photos of me with Luol Deng during his first visit to our Voice of America headquarters.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
The Voice of America.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. President Obama's favorite sport is basketball, but I'm guessing he might be watching some tennis this week in New York City. In New York, American tennis stars Venus and Serena Williams will renew their sibling rivalry on Tuesday in the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open. Serena is bidding for the first calendar year Grand Slam, a sweep of the four major tournaments since 1988, when now-retired German star Steffi Graf did it. Serena advanced to the quarterfinals Sunday with a 6-3, 6-3 victory over American countrywoman Madison Keys. Meanwhile, her older sister, 35-year-old Venus, set up another Williams sisters showdown by beating 19-year-old Estonian qualifier Anett Kontaveit in straight sets 6-2 and 6-1. Serena says Venus has been playing some great tennis and she'll really have to be ready on Tuesday. Overall, Serena holds a 15-11 advantage over Venus in their career meetings. If Serena can win her fourth consecutive U.S. Open title, she'll tie Steffi Graf with 22 Grand Slam singles titles. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhib.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the first part of a series on the area often described as the most dangerous place in South Africa. And next, in Sierra Leone, an experimental Ebola vaccine is being deployed in Cambia district, where a new case of the virus was detected recently. But first, some music. Here is Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa Higher Higher.
Priceless.
put yourself upon its throne. Hey, hey, hey. 20 years for power.
What?
30 plus and 14 more.
30 plus and 14 more.
All the worries that my family and my friends they're finding.
Cameroon's Deborah Debs with Africa, Higher, Higher. Deep Sloot is a large township north of the South Africa's biggest city, Johannesburg. The world heard about the township in 2008 when several foreigners were murdered there by xenophobic mobs. Then the South African government pledged to develop Deep Sloot. Some upgrades have happened, but the township continues to be a place of poverty, intense misery, terrible violent crime, disease, and death. Darren Taylor takes us inside Deep Sloot in the first part of a series on the area, often described as the most dangerous place in South Africa.
Children play in the dust of Deep Sloot, under towers of rotting trash steaming in the sun. Rivulets of human waste flow around them. They're watched by a tiny, elderly white woman with fiery red hair. Glennis van Holter has been establishing community projects in Deep Sloot for 20 years.
Desperate, poverty-stricken, violent, dirty, ugly, and very, very little to smile about. Very little. There's a lot of rubbish lying around. Rats as big as cats.
Local police statistics show 600,000 people live in Deep Sloot. And as Johannesburg spreads northwards, so the township grows. New people from all over the country and the continent arrive all the time, hoping to find work on numerous nearby building sites. But most remain unemployed, living in a shack land that stretches to the horizon. Residents like Nkululeko Ngube say crime is so bad in Deep Sloot that even the police are afraid to enter the area.
I can't pinpoint, but everybody's a criminal.
Everyone in Deep Sloot is a criminal?
Yes, I would say so.
Taxi conductors shout the names of destinations at prospective passengers. These chaotic streets are the territory of community reporter Golden Mtika.
In Deep Sloot, murder has become a very common thing. Every weekend, the pathology would come in and pick up 4 or 5 dead bodies. Last year, November, we had 22 murders in 1 month. So you can imagine the type of community that we are living in.
Despite this, police members say only 4 police officers usually patrol Deep Sloot at any given time. This, they say, is a major reason for all the violent crime. Van Holter says every weekend, Deep Sloot explodes.
Shootings, robberies, murders, xenophobia, rapes, beatings, you name it.
She tells of a recent case where a man chained a 14-year-old girl up in his shack and for several weeks used her as a sex slave. Van Holter says one night, the victim managed to run away.
The man chased her and he found her. He hit her with rocks, so he knocked her out and just left her there. We found her a week later.
Deep Sloot community leader Brown Lekekela says gangs of men often target shacks occupied by women.
They will say, shut up. They have sex with you, three, four of them, or six of them. Then they will take maybe your cell phone, your valuables, and go out.
Hey, how's it? Barania?
Ntika walks past electronic repair shops. Almost everyone has an Arabic name.
People, they have lost the trust in the police and also the frustration. In a place like this one, Deep Slut, where a lot of foreigners, they happen to have migrated here, they've flocked into this township in large numbers.
Lekakela says fast population growth without a corresponding increase in basic services is feeding crime and violence in Deep Slut. He says locals get angry when they have to compete for basic services and jobs with foreigners.
There are too many here. They are not more than us here in Deep Slut, but they are getting there. In most of the squatter camps that are around Deep Slut, they are occupied by the foreign nationals, documented and undocumented.
A woman watches children sing at a creche. Her three-year-old daughter was once a pupil here. Now she's in her grave, abducted, raped, and murdered. The mother, like many here, says there are so many criminals in Deep Slut because it's easy for them to hide in the maze of shacks.
There are many shacks. So if someone do something, like, you cannot actually see because there are many shacks and they are combined.
Lekakela says there's so much violence in Deep Slut because people here live in permanent fury, as he puts it.
Most people, they are angry because they feel like the government is neglecting them.
Van Holter warns that the people of Deep Slut are so dehumanized that they have nothing to live for, and that one day soon their anger could spill all over the city. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Deep Slut, South Africa.
In Sierra Leone, an experimental Ebola vaccine is being deployed in Cambia district, where a new case of the virus was detected recently. The World Health Organization and Ministry of Health team will offer the experimental VSV-EBOV vaccine to those who've been exposed to the Ebola virus. WHO spokesperson Dr. Margaret Harris tells Ricky Shryock fast action and coordination with the Sierra Leone government has been extraordinary.
It's the first time it's been used in a ring method in Sierra Leone, but it's part of an ongoing trial, and the ring method is the method that's been used in that trial in Guinea. And the important thing is the Sierra Leonean government said, look, we would like to have the opportunity to have anybody exposed to a new case to be offered vaccination as part of the trial as well. It was quite extraordinary how quickly the two countries cooperated together.
Because this is just a vaccine that only in July was deemed something that could possibly work, correct?
It's still only something that could possibly work. What's going on in Sierra Leone is still part of the same experiment. What's really new and interesting here is that one government said to another government and said to us as WHO as well, can we be part of this? We would like, as part of the experiment, to be able to offer this to our people, because the principle of ring vaccination is if you have a case, all the people that are known to have come in contact with the infected person, all those people are offered vaccination, and then also the contacts of those people. So in other words, you put a big buffer zone right around the person who's been infected.
Am I correct? In Guinea, it's a ring vaccination trial. So in that case, in a trial like this, where you're trying to determine the efficacy of a vaccine, do you not have to give some people the actual vaccine and some people a placebo? Now, in both Guinea and Sierra Leone, the vaccine is offered to everyone within that ring right away.
That's right. It's provided right away. Of course, the first thing you have to do, you don't just sort of walk into a village and say, okay, you know, everybody who's been in contact, you know, line up and have a vaccine. The very first thing you do is go and sit with all the people who are affected and say, okay, these are the circumstances, this is what this vaccine is, this is what it does, this is the trial. It is an experimental trial still, and it still follows a certain protocol. And you make sure that people really understand all the elements of the trial and that it is still an experimental trial. And only then, when you're quite satisfied that everybody understands and can give true consent, so they've understood in their own language and they've had long discussions about it, only then do you commence with the vaccination. So that still takes a couple of days. And of course, it takes a day or to identify who all the people who may have come into contact.
And it takes a day or two to get to these places sometimes.
It takes a while. But actually, again, it's extraordinary how quickly the Guinea team got up to in Cambia.
That was Dr. Margaret Harris, spokesperson for the World Health Organization. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Guinea. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, America pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's strength and prosperity. The notion that work is valued and even noble dates to the ancients. "Seest thou a man diligent in his labor?" the book of Proverbs asks. "He shall stand before kings." In the United States, the belief goes back well over a century. As a holiday, the Labor Day celebration began in the 1880s in New York City with an effort by labor unions to demonstrate the numbers, strength, and spirit of working men and women. They organized parades and rallies and used the demonstrations to press for new laws to benefit workers, such as standardizing the 8-hour workday. The movement spread to other cities, and in 1894, Congress made it a national holiday honoring all American workers. The association with trade and labor unions has declined over the years. Today, for most people, the holiday represents the last long weekend of summer, a time to relax and spend time with family and friends. There are still parades and rallies, particularly in election years, and also sporting events and picnics. For many, Labor Day means a no Labor Day before the change of seasons and start of a new school year. Over time, work in the U.S. itself has changed. More Americans now are occupied in offices and services than who toil on the factory floor. The connection between the holiday and the nation's workers remains real, though, as recognition of the source of so much of America's economic and social achievements.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Next on Let's Talk, wife earning more money than her husband. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing this sensitive issue. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity, Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.